This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Just about the worst news a parent can get is the news the doctor gave our first guest, Emily Rapp, when her son Ronan was 9 months old. Ronan had Tay-Sachs, a disease that leads to the degeneration of brain tissue and results in the body's systems gradually shutting down. Tay-Sachs is acquired genetically, but only when both parents are carriers of the defective Tay-Sachs gene. Emily Rapp has written a heartbreaking memoir about raising a child she knew did not have long to live. Ronan died 1 month ago, before his third birthday. Emily's first book, Poster Child, was about her own congenital defect, a bone and tissue disorder that led to the amputation of one leg. She actually was a poster child for the March of Dimes in 1980. Now she has a pretty state-of-the-art prosthetic. Rapp is a former Fulbright scholar, a graduate of Harvard Divinity School, and now is a professor of creative writing and literature at the Santa Fe University of Art and Design. Her new memoir is called The Still Point of the Turning World. She spoke with Terry last Monday.
Emily Rapp, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'm so sorry about your son's death.
Thank you.
Let's start with a reading about getting the diagnosis that your son Ronan had Tay-Sachs disease. And in this part of your memoir, you're in the doctor's office and you and your husband are in shock because you just got the diagnosis.
"Well, what can we do about it?" Rick asked, glancing between me and Ronan and the doctor. But I knew enough about Tay-Sachs to know that there was nothing at all for us to do, and that my life, the life as a new and hopeful mother, was over. The doctor looked at the two of us. "No, I'm so sorry," he said. "There's no way to fix it." "They die," I stuttered. I had the sensation of skin falling away from bone. I hugged Ronan more tightly. "They die." I wanted to vomit, and my grip on Ronan was scaring him. I loosened my arms slightly. "What?" Rick asked. "Surely they die," I said, firmly in a high-pitched voice, and this time he understood that I meant Ronan. That Ronan, our boy, our baby, our child, would die. The world was broken, and the three of us, Ronan, Rick, and I, were falling into its mouth. Nerve damage begins in the womb and progresses quickly, leading to dementia, decreased interaction with the environment, seizures, spasticity, and eventually death. Paralysis, blindness, deafness, loss of all faculties.
That's Emily Rapp reading from her new memoir, The Still Point of the Turning World, about her son Ronan, who was diagnosed at 9 months with Tay-Sachs disease and died in February. Emily, when you got the diagnosis, like you said, you knew babies with Tay-Sachs die, and that there was really nothing you could do to prevent that. There's no cure.
Right.
There's no treatment. But there are things you could do to keep him as comfortable as he'd be capable of being. What were some of those things you could do?
Well, he loved, because as he went blind, he sort of had an experience that was entirely somatic. He went on a lot of hikes. He went to a lot of parties.
When you say he went on a lot of hikes, you mean you carried
him? I hiked with him.
Yes.
he did not hike. I hiked with him, and we took him outside and a lot of walks in the stroller. And I sort of, the way that I processed his, I think, sort of regression into this state of non-movement and non-interaction was to introduce him to probably as many people as I possibly could. So I invited almost every friend I've ever had throughout my life to come and see him and visit him and hold him. And he also loved to eat. He was really into food. And so he ate a lot. And, you know, very simple, simple day-to-day things that he enjoyed.
So, you know, parents always learn about developmental milestones, you know, at what age the baby usually starts walking and saying mama, papa, or whatever the name is for their parents. And, you know, when they understand that something is out of the room or in the room and all of this. And you had to learn what the reverse milestones were going to be, the signs of his regression, of his slow shutting down. What were you told to watch out for?
Seizures, first of all, and those were controlled by medication, so that was one intervention that we chose. They just kind of stop. They stop at 6 months, and then they sort of unravel from there. And it happened over such a long, torturous period that it's kind of difficult for me to remember when those things happened, because it usually wasn't very dramatic. It was just a very, very slow fade. So, but you're constantly, when you have a child with a terminal illness, part of the devastation of the caring is that you live with constant dread. And it's not just dread, but it's dread that's going to lead to the most dreadful thing. So it's like a horror story in that sense. But being with Ronan was actually great because he was so sweet and fun to be around, and everyone loved him, and he was a gorgeous baby and had his own little personality despite having Tay-Sachs.
So excuse me for asking this, but when you say he was fun to be around, what do you mean?
He had just this amazing energy. I mean, first of all, before his illness progressed to the point where he was no longer interactive, he would play with toys and he giggled and he would look at you and smile. I mean, he was like, a regular baby. Later, when he became less interactive, he just, his presence was so, I don't use this word lightly, I think powerful. I mean, people really responded to him because he was just totally at ease, if that makes sense. He was just quiet and peaceful and sweet. It was just a joy to be around him.
Emily, you took your son to hospice, and they talked to you about how you'd have to make decisions about how far to go with interventions.
Right.
Like you'd have to decide if you're going to do a feeding tube or not. Mm-hmm. What were some of the turning points the people at the hospice told you you'd have to look out for and have to make a big decision about whether to go on or let him go?
Well, it's interesting because what's great about hospice is that they're really like moment to moment. So there'd be a day when he was coughing a lot and I would, one of us would call and say, he's coughing a lot. What can we do to make him more comfortable? Or it looks like he doesn't want to take food anymore. So it actually wasn't like they didn't sort of plot it out for us because everybody is different. And because they watch people and accompany people while they unravel into death, which is sort of how it was described to me, then there's no real, it's not so much looking out as it's just watching and just saying, okay, what's today like? And not sort of fast forwarding into tomorrow, which is really hard to do. But they were great. I mean, they were available at all times and would work with all kinds of people to do things that are in their comfort zone, whether or not that's, at the end saying like, okay, give all the machines, we can't let him go. They don't have any judgment about those decisions. So I think that's a very safe place to be when you're asked to make bad decisions, but people aren't going to judge you for what you do.
When you say bad decisions, you mean like painful decisions?
Painful, yeah. I don't mean bad as in morally bad. I mean,
right, yeah.
To have to make a decision about whatever it is, what kind of seizure medication, or he's having trouble doing this, do we start to use the suction machine, do we not? All of those decisions are sort of don't have happy endings in either case, but there's not a right way to do it, and they're very adamant about emphasizing that.
You write that at each stage of potential intervention, the hospice medical staff would say things like, ask yourself, what does this lead to and what is it for?
Mm. Right.
Can you describe what that meant to you?
I just think it meant that, getting a terminal diagnosis like Tay-Sachs, it's difficult to say, well, if I do this, he's going to get another 6 months or whatever, because he may not want another 6 months. His body may suffer more if he has that additional time. So it was really just saying, okay, well, if we stop food or if we use this oxygen machine, it's not making his life extend, which was what we didn't want to do. It was making it comfortable. So it's kind of hard to describe it because it's so unique to each baby. And they're so adept at kind of leading you through and just saying, well, how's today? What does it seem like? Taking his vital signs. It's really difficult to describe how in the moment it is.
So did you find yourself constantly having to think about what level of life was meaningful for your son, what level of life was worth preserving?
I think so. That was the worst part, was nobody wants to lose their child. I mean, it's horrible. It's the worst thing you can imagine. But I also, didn't want him to suffer. And that was really the sort of the primal impulse shifted from how am I going to launch this child into the world, to how am I going to, you know, make it possible for him to have the most peaceful passing, which is also could be framed as a primal parenting goal. So that's a very big shift, but it is still a kind of parenting. You know, Ronan was a very loved boy, and I don't think he suffered terribly. I hope not. It's hard. Of course, he couldn't really tell us. But that's when the hospice came in, and they'd say, well, this is what happens when the body does this, or this is what happens when the body does that. And so they were sort of the guide just when he stopped having obvious clues or cues to how he was feeling.
What were the turning points for you where you had to decide, is this the end? Should it be the end? Should we do something that will probably help him live longer, or is it time to let him go?
You know, I think I won't talk about that just because it's I don't really want to talk about his death so much. And those decisions were so wrenching that I'm not sure I want them public, if that's all right.
That's fine. And yeah. I certainly respect that. Could you gauge his level of pain at all, since his responses were not kind of typical responses and there was a limit to his ability to communicate?
I think so. I mean, the thing about, you know, Ronan was that people were watching him all the time, looking at him and touching him. So when there was a problem, it was pretty evident, I think. And it's hard to describe it to someone because the cues are so subtle, and people who cared for him on a regular basis would understand them, and people who didn't would probably miss them. But since he had sort of the same caretakers for most of his life, we got it. But yeah, he was, and you know, most of the time he looked so peaceful, most of the time. He slept a lot, and he loved to be held, and those are the kinds of memories that I try to focus on when, I mean, obviously when I'm sad, which is all the time, but I like to think about him when he was just peaceful and happy, and that, you know, now he's free of any of the suffering he might have experienced, as now he is set free from that, and that is a relief.
When your son was first diagnosed with Tay-Sachs in January 2011, when he was 9 months old, among the many things that panicked you was the thought that maybe you hadn't gotten tested for Tay-Sachs. You thought you did, but maybe you didn't really. And it's, you know, it's a genetically passed on disease. You were tested. You confirmed that you were tested.
Yes.
And yet it wasn't detected. Can you explain why?
Yes. Tay-Sachs disease is commonly understood as a disease that's manifests in the Ashkenazi Jewish population. This has been the sort of standard genetic counseling advice, and is what people often say is when you say Tay-Sachs, they say, oh, but how can your baby have Tay-Sachs? You're not Jewish. So there's a real connection between having Ashkenazi Jewish heritage and being at risk for Tay-Sachs. So when I asked for the Tay-Sachs test, they said, well, you don't really need it because you're not Jewish. And I said, I'd like to have it anyway. But Tay-Sachs has 100-plus mutations, genetic mutations, and the standard prenatal test detects, I think, 9 of them, and all 9 are common to the Ashkenazi Jewish population. So there's a whole other set of mutations that aren't detected by that test. So, yeah, I have a genetic mutation that apparently, which was a shock to me, manifests mostly in people who are Moroccan. Who knows? Our genes are old and weird and mysterious. So that's why when I had the test, I didn't think I needed to worry. And also Tay-Sachs is very rare. There's that too. So I thought I was in the clear in that respect.
So you had a genetic test that did not show that you were a carrier for Tay-Sachs.
That's right.
You've written that had you known from prenatal tests that you were carrying a baby who had Tay-Sachs, that you would have had an abortion, you're right, without question and without regret. Mm-hmm. Although this would have been a different kind of loss to mourn and would by no means have been a cavalier or uncomplicated decision or a heartless decision. And then you write, I'm so grateful that Ronan is my child. I also wish he'd never been born.
Yeah.
Can you tell us, and I know this would be hard to talk about, why you feel it would have been an act of love to have an abortion had you known?
I think Tay-Sachs is, what's so devastating about it is there's just nothing to do. It's so hard to watch a baby begin a life of being a baby, being a person, and then just lose everything. It's devastating to the child. It's devastating to the parents. It's just a death sentence. It's not a disease that is manageable in the sense that there might be interventions that would really increase quality of life. And if I had known that, if I could have spared a child the kind of life that Ronan had, I would, because he died. I mean, his brain didn't function, and he didn't really have a chance to live in the world in this full, rich way that I think is sort of should be everyone's birthright. That doesn't mean that I have a disability myself, so I have very, you know, strong opinions about the fact that bodies can be all kinds of ways and that there are all kinds of manifestations of physical ability. So I don't think it's, again, I'm not cavalier about that decision, but I would have, yes, because it would have saved suffering on so many levels.
Would you like to end by sharing one of your favorite memories of your son?
Yes, that's such a good idea. I have a friend of mine came to visit, and I don't remember. I think it was the summer. It would have been August of 2011. My friend Megan, and we went on a hike in the Borrego Trail, which is a hiking trail near in the Santa Fe Mountains. And I had Ronan in the front pack because he was still small enough to be carried. And we took him out, and my friend Megan takes like a million pictures, so there's so many photos of this day, which might be why I remember it. So I thank her for doing that. I took him out of the pack and just like we kind of rolled him around in the mud. And he just thought it was like the funniest thing ever. He loved it. And he was kind of giggling, and we were moving his arms and legs and stuff, but it was clear that he was happy and looked like he was enjoying himself, and of course got completely covered in mud. So that's one of my favorite memories. And a lot of them are just, I loved taking walks with him, and I loved sleeping with him in the bed, sort of snuggling him, and sort of having him in the front pack and having him close. Like his body was very comforting to me in its sort of sweet presence. So I have a lot of really beautiful memories of him.
Well, Emily Rapp, thank you for sharing some memories about your son. Thanks for talking with us about his brief life. And I wish you well.
Thank you.
Emily Rapp's new memoir is called The Still Point of the Turning World. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm TV critic David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Last Sunday saw the conclusion of the second season of the HBO series Girls. Taking its place this weekend, HBO Films presents a new made-for-TV movie called Phil Spector. It's a production that demands attention because of the heavyweight names attached. First, of course, there's the subject of the drama, Spector himself, the man who invented the wall of sound and recorded hits for everyone from the Crystals, Darlene Love, and Ike and Tina Turner to the Beatles and the Righteous Brothers. Oh, and who also went on trial in 2007 for the 2003 shooting death of actress Lana Clarkson. He claimed she shot herself with one of his many guns. The prosecution argued that he put the gun barrel in her mouth and pulled the trigger. Then there are the names attached to this dramatization. Barry Levinson is the executive producer. David Mamet is both writer and director. Jeffrey Tambor plays the leading defense attorney, Bruce Cutler, who brings in attorney Linda Kenny Baden as a last-minute co-counsel. Linda is played by Helen Mirren, and Al Pacino plays Phil Spector. Almost the entire movie focuses on those last two, with Linda trying to get to know Spector quickly while mounting a defense and assessing whether he should be put on the stand. But what demands the most attention here, to me, isn't the subject or the production team or the stars. It's the opening disclaimer written by Mamet as a preface to his story. I've been a TV critic for more than 35 years now, and I've never seen anything quite like it. Even though it's based on actual people and concerns an actual event, here is the disclaimer to the movie called Phil Spector. Quote, "This is a work of fiction. It's not based on a true story. It is a drama inspired by actual persons in a trial, but it is neither an attempt to depict the actual persons, nor to comment upon the trial or its outcome." Unquote. Mamet may as well have written, "Don't anybody sue us. I'm just making stuff up using names and a few bits of court testimony that are in the public record." Except if you look closely at the credits for this HBO work of fiction, you'll find that Linda Kenny Baden, the attorney played by Helen Mirren, serves as a consultant. So even though her exchanges with the real Phil Spector are protected by attorney-client privilege, you get the feeling, at least I do, that Mamet may not be winging it as much as he claims to be with that disclaimer. But take that disclaimer seriously. You can't trust what you see in this HBO movie, but you can and should enjoy it. This Phil Spector movie, essentially, is a two-person play, an awkward dance between Linda and her eccentric client as he reveals his shifting psychological states by jamming his mental gears between charming remarks, challenging questions, and emotional rants. Pacino is an actor set at hurricane force here, and Mirren matches him by countering his fury with her calm. Mamet's dialogue, as expected, is crisp and thought-provoking, and these two acting pros make the most of it. Here's a scene from their first meeting, when Linda visits Phil's mansion and he reaches for a vinyl record to put on the turntable as they talk.
As your attorney, I must counsel you not, whatever the provocation, not to talk to anyone.
They're indicting me for murder. All right, sorry. You lost that loving feeling. What was it? Are you kidding me? What was it? It was the greatest song ever released. I sold over 2.5 million copies. You say the Jews invented the music business. The Jews didn't invent the music business. I invented the music business. 7th Avenue, New York, there's a statue, little old Jewish guy, yarmulke, bent over a sewing machine. He's that guy invented ready-to-wear. I invented the music business. Where's a statue of me? Where's the presidential medal? Sidney Poitier broke the color barrier? Are you kidding me? He was playing Superman. You want to know who he was? He was an uptight, frightened white guy's version of a black man. I put the Ronettes in their home. I put black America in the white home. First time you got felt up, first time you got somebody's hand on you, guess what? You were listening to one of my songs.
Did you kill that girl?
I thought attorneys never asked that question.
This Phil Spector movie does ask that question, but never answers it, and never even tries to. In essence, it reminds me of Fatal Vision, the famous 1984 miniseries about preparations for the murder trial of Jeffrey McDonald. But even there, that story's author, Joe McGinnis, eventually came down on one side and delivered his own verdict, even making himself a character in that drama. In the HBO movie Phil Spector, the only verdict comes at the end, when we're told what the jury decided at the end of Spector's days in court. And after the movie is all over, I'm left with my final verdict as well. I may not believe a lot of what I see in HBO's Phil Spector, but I'm certainly impressed and entertained by it.
See the way he walks down the street. That's the way he shuffles.
Last Tuesday was Philip Roth's 80th birthday. He's widely acknowledged as America's greatest living novelist. And it's an event that seems all the more momentous as Roth recently announced his retirement from writing fiction. In connection with his birthday, there's a new documentary called Philip Roth Unmasked that will be shown as part of the PBS American Masters series on March 29th. Our critic at large, John Powers, a huge Roth fan, has seen the documentary and says it got him thinking about how you celebrate a writer whose virtues aren't high-minded and pleasant.
In Chinua Achebe's novel, The Anthills of the Savannah, one of the characters says, "Poets don't give prescriptions, they give headaches." The same is true of novelists, none more so than Philip Roth. If any writer has ever enjoyed rattling people's skulls, it's this son of Newark, New Jersey, who's currently enjoying something of a victory lap in the media on the occasion of his 80th birthday. The celebration reaches its peak in a new documentary, Philip Roth Unmasked, that will screen on PBS next week as part of the American Masters series. Now, there's no doubt that Roth is a master, and not just an American one. His first book, Goodbye Columbus, won the National Book Award in 1960, and he's been racking up prizes ever since. From the beginning, Roth was nobody's idea of the artist who sits invisibly behind his work, paring his fingernails. The hilariously obscene Portnoy's complaint made him into something of a pop icon, and his later creation of fictional alter egos have let readers spy on imaginary versions of everything from his fame and his back pain to all the hot sex he presumably was having. Even as Roth grappled with the elusive nature of the self, he also reached outward. His novels tackle topics that stir the hornet's nest: sex, Jewishness, politics, marriage, Israel, the legacy of the 1960s. Roth has always been a writer willing to butcher sacred cows and to talk about things that others think taboo. Whether riffing on masturbation or being irreverent about Anne Frank, he's ripped through illusions and bad faith, like a man stripping cobwebs out of an attic. Of course, it takes enormous confidence to say what other people aren't willing to. In Philip Roth Unmasked, he talks about his willingness to go for broke on the page.
I was very curious, as a writer, as to how far I could go. What happens if you go further? It's best, certainly in the early stages of a book, to abandon self-censorship. Do whatever you want to do. Let it be. Shame isn't for writers. You have to be shameless. You can't worry about being decorous. This doesn't mean that you have to be obscene and crazy and smear your pages with feces. That's not the point. But shame won't do. I couldn't have written Sabbath's Theater if I felt shame. I couldn't have written... I feel plenty of shame in my own life, don't get me wrong. I'm just as shame-ridden as the next person is. But when I sit down to write, I'm free from shame.
As you can hear, Roth speaks lucidly and well. He's really fun to listen to. And in this documentary, he comes across as a smart, thoughtful, rather harmless man who loved his parents and devoted 60 years to his craft. This isn't really surprising. After all, it's the nature of the American Master series to be laudatory and upbeat about culture, to suggest that the person being celebrated has done work that's somehow noble and good for you. Now, this might be a plausible approach to a literary politician like John Updike. But Roth is a guy who once wrote, "For a pure sense of being tumultuously alive, you can't beat the nasty side of existence." And this idea reverberates through his work. Here's a writer who specializes in anger, sarcasm, iconoclasm, dirtiness, atheism, comedy, and sexual attitudes that smack of misogyny. While Philip Roth Unmasked doesn't completely ignore his dark ferocity, it tiptoes around it. We learn little about his personal life, which was messy enough to prompt his ex-wife, actress Claire Bloom, to spend 150 pages of a book excoriating his manipulative narcissism. Nor do we get much insight into what's obvious from Roth's work: his ambition, his princely sense of entitlement, his use of fury as fuel, his tendency toward political sanctimony, and his way of seeing women as one big perk of fame. Watching Philip Roth Unmasked, I couldn't help but compare it to his 1988 autobiography, The Facts, where Roth spends the first 157 pages presenting himself pretty much the way he does in the documentary, as a smart, hardworking, somewhat flawed Jewish guy from Newark. But Roth is too honest to leave it at that. He'd no more let us believe that he's actually this boringly simple than he'd let himself believe in the balm of an afterlife. And so he ends The Facts with an imaginary letter in which one of his alter egos, Nathan Zuckerman, scrutinizes this autobiography and rips into all the ways that Roth has smoothed out the truth, creating an official version that sounds honest enough, but actually leaves out the pulp of life in all its fury, mire, and nastiness. In Roth's novella, The Dying Animal, the narrator talks about learning to play classical music. Like all enjoyable things, he says, it has unenjoyable parts to it. The same is surely true of learning to appreciate Philip Roth himself.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. Coming up, we'll hear some modern versions of old sea shanties and pirate ballads performed by the likes of Tom Waits, Keith Richards, and Shane McGowan. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. A new album finds old songs reinterpreted by Tom Waits, Patti Smith, Michael Stipe, Richard Thompson, Macy Gray, Iggy Pop, and others. It's called Son of Rogues Gallery, Pirate Ballads, Sea Songs, and Shanties. It's called Son of because it's the sequel to a 2006 album called Rogues Gallery. Both were produced by our next guest, Hal Wilner. He came up with the pirate song concept with Johnny Depp and director Gore Verbinski when they were on the set of the second Pirates of the Caribbean movie. Wilner is known for producing tribute albums with new interpretations of Nino Rota, Thelonious Monk, Charles Mingus, Kurt Vile, and songs from classic Disney animated films. Since 1980, Wilner has worked on Saturday Night Live handling music for sketches. He spoke with Terry last Thursday, and they began with a song from Son of Rogues Gallery. Here's Shane McGowan of the Pogues doing Leaving of Liverpool.
Very well, that princess lies on the stage. There are many fairy wells. I am bound for California, a place I know right well. So fairy well, my own true love. When I return, united we will be. It's not the leaving of Liverpool that grieves me. When we turn.
That's Shane McGowan from the new Hal Wilner anthology, Son of Rogues Gallery, Pirate Ballads, Sea Songs, and Shanties. Hal Wilner, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's really a pleasure to have you. He sure growls that one. Tell us about Shane McGowan and why he belongs on this collection.
Oh, he was one of the first ones that we thought belonged on the collection. In fact, he's sung these type of songs forever. I mean, he's a true pirate. I know he's got a reputation, but...
A reputation for what?
Outrageous behavior, a lot of alcohol in his act. And once you get past the fact that he talks like White Fang from Soupy Sales... and start to understand what he says. He's one of the most well-read, sophisticated people I've ever met. So he knew exactly what he wanted to do. And then he went in the vocal booth and nailed it in take one.
Mm.
Perfectly. And then you saw that weird Nosferatu vampire face through the glass smiling at you.
And I'll tell you, I'll make a confession to you, Hal Wilner. I've never thought of myself as liking sea shanties. I've kind of avoided them. I listen to a lot of music. That's one form I've kind of avoided. And now I think, oh, yeah, these are great songs. When you started researching pirate songs, did you go into the history of the songs, too? Did you just want the music, or did you want, like, a larger context for the songs?
I did a bit of research into the history. I mean, one had to, especially just when listening to those amazing folkways, Smithsonian recordings of real sailors singing it, because they would explain the history and where it came from and what they added to it. And then also seeing all the different places they were written at or came from. It was consistent Liverpool, Cape Cod, South Australia, places that, you know, there were ports. Interesting, Sean Lennon, who's on the record, told me about how much his dad loved and was influenced by these songs. Once again, Liverpool, one of the big ports. And one listens carefully to some of the Beatles things, you will hear certain lines from some of these songs in it.
I want to play another track. And this one is by Tom Waits, accompanied by Keith Richards. They've performed together before. And you said they were supposed to be on the first volume of your Sea Shanty and Pirate Songs, but because of timing, they didn't make it. First of all, what's it like to watch the two of them work together? They're both such big personalities and interesting people.
To be honest, they weren't in the studio at the same time. But
oh, no wonder
matter.
They get along so well.
No, they don't need kidding. To be in the same studio. I mean, I was actually, but both of them I've worked with quite a bit. Tom was one of the first people on our records from 85.
He sang Hi-Ho, was it the work
yes.
song? Yeah.
Hi-Ho, Hi-Ho and What Keeps Mankind Alive.
Oh, yeah.
And so I've known him since the mid-80s. And Keith, we did was on the Charles Mingus record we did, Lord Don't Drop That Atomic Bomb, and I've recorded him with Marianne Faithfull. So there was already a comfort thing there. But Tom, I mean, you've interviewed him. Though he could be one of the great spontaneous artists, doesn't really work that way. So it was a long process to pick the right song. And then we tried it three different ways before he found the way that he was happy with.
There's a chorus behind him. Is that Waits overdubbing himself?
Yeah, that's a chorus of Tom's with Keith sailing over it. Once again, we tried it with a rhythm section, tried it with a jazz band, and then he fell in love with a version that was done by the ex-Siemens Institute, where it was a call and response thing. And he just went and recorded this orchestra of Waits, and Keith came in later and like, what do I do on this? And we worked like, for him, it's a long time to work 2 or 3 hours. But he found it, and that smile came on his face when he did. And he was Keith on that track, and then beautifully sang along. You hear it. So once again, they know each other so well, they started working together on Rain Dogs. So, I mean, they might as well have been in the same room.
Okay, so this is Tom Waits with Keith Richards doing the classic Shenandoah.
10 long years I courted Sally, away in a river. She broke my heart here in this valley, away without a way. Cross the line, Missouri. The Missouri, she's a mighty river. She's a mighty river.
Tom Waits and Keith Richards performing Shenandoah from the new collection of pirate ballads, sea songs, and shanties called Son of Rogues Gallery. And this is the second collection of songs like this that were produced by my guest, Hal Wilner. Now, this is probably the best-known song, or one of the best-known songs on the album. And did you say it was Waits who chose it?
Yeah, I sent him... I mean, in the case of Tom, I sent him a lot more songs than I would normally send. He keeps telling me, and it was old recordings of Sailors and all that, and he keeps saying that's the record that would have been best to release, the tape I sent him. But at the end of it, he just, I think it was maybe the ex-Siemens as opposed to the song itself. Or maybe it was a song he always wanted to do. And it is. It does fit into this type of song. It fits into a lot of ways. It was probably the hallelujah of its day. I mean, fits as a cowboy song, fits as this. And at the end of it, he said, no, there's something about Shenandoah. So Yeah, be my guest.
Now, you said one of the things that you found in your research going through pirate songs was pirate poems.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those poems is sung by Mary Margaret O'Hara, whose work I'm not familiar with. I'd like to get to know it now. I think this is a terrific track. Would you tell us a little bit about this poem and her approach to turning it into a song?
Well, I love exposing people to things. Now, Mary Margaret O'Hara is from Canada and from a very talented family. Her sister is Catherine O'Hara, the actor.
Right, and actress who started on SCTV and
yes.
was in Home Alone films. And
also brilliant and quirky.
Oh, and in a lot of those Christopher Guest documentaries?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Mary, I met her when she was in a band called Godeo Chorus. She went on her own, and she made one of the greatest records I've ever heard in my life, Miss America. Came out in the 80s, and she's not really put out another solo record since. But she's, you know, like came out of a cave or something. You don't hear any influences. And everything she does is a surprise, and every emotion you'll get listening to her.
Did you choose the poem and give it to her?
No, I gave her the book of poetry. Mary will often, when coming into one of these projects, not decide on what she wants to do until she's already on stage in the studio. And then at the end of the day, she picked up this book of poetry and just started going through it and cutting up different poems and just singing the lyrics. The band was in the room, and they just started playing behind her. But, I mean, it's always the perfect way to end the records.
And so this is Mary Margaret O'Hara singing the poem, "Then Said the Captain to Me."
When on the seas high ships have dropped beyond my sky, and life's trumpet leaves my lips, and women pass me by, dear God, let me die, dear God, let me die, dear God, let me die. When all the seas, high ships have dropped beyond my sky, and life's trumpet leaves my lips, and woman pass me by, dear God, let me die, dear God, let me die, dear God, let me die, dear God, let me die. All the seas, high ships have dropped beyond my sky. It leaves my lips, and women pass me by, dear God, let me die, dear God, let me die, dear God, let me die.
That's Mary Margaret O'Hara from the second volume of Pirate Ballads, Sea Songs and Shanties, produced by my guest Hal Wilner, and this volume is called Son of Rogues Gallery. I love the way she sings Let Me Die. And I'm surprised the poem isn't called that.
No, but that was a line, obviously, that she latched onto while she was singing it. Again, she did not rehearse this and come in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
She just started going through the book and singing it. So obviously, she tuned into the same line you just did and kept repeating it. Let me die, let me die. And, I mean, it's, as you said, beautiful, and, I mean, there's a period to this, you know, to show the other side that these sea voyages were not all joyful.
Let's hear another song from your new collection of pirate songs and sea shanties. And the album's called Son of Rogues Gallery because it's volume two of the Rogues Gallery collection of songs. I guess it's Hal Wilner who produced these albums. And the next song that I want to play is Pirate Jenny, which isn't really a pirate song per se. It's a show tune. I mean, it's from Three Penny Opera, the great Kurt Weill Bertolt Brecht collaboration. So I thought it was an interesting, surprising choice for this. And The performer is somebody who I am not familiar with. I was prepared to not like this because I thought, oh, gosh knows what they're going to do with this. I love the Threepenny Opera, but I think it's really quite good. So tell us a little bit about the performer, how you know her, and why you chose her.
Well, this is how this happened. Often the magic, the thing that makes it work, are the artists that are not known at the time. And in this one, Larry Ratso Sloman took Nick Cave and I to see Shilpa Ray, who plays harmonium. She had a band called Shilpa Ray and the Happy Hookers. And watching her was just, right away, one of those, this artist is incredible. Pirate Jenny is, I see it as a sea song, but it was one I was not going to have on the record, because what does one do with it that hasn't been done? Dylan always stated Pirate Jenny as the song that showed him where writing or songwriting can go.
So you thought that Shilpa Ray was right for Pirate Jenny. Did she know the song?
Nope. Didn't.
So how did you introduce her to the song? Did you give her an album or sheet music?
I gave her three different versions. Four maybe. A lot of Lenya's, Nina Simone's, Ellen Green's from, and B. Arthur from the old soundtracks. And she got the attitude. I mean, you could tell she got the attitude. And came in and killed it. And being that Nick Cave has taken an interest in her, took her on the road with him, they were totally up for Nick and Warren Ellis participating on the track. So they overdubbed some subtle parts.
Yeah, and he's doing some very quiet backup vocals on it.
And piano, yeah.
Mm, okay. Okay, so this is Shilpa Ray singing the Kurt Weill, Bertolt Brecht song, Pirate Jenny, and it's from the new collection of pirate ballads, sea songs, and shanties called Son of Rogues Gallery.
You people can watch while I'm scrubbing these floors, and I'm scrubbing these floors while you're gawking. And maybe once you tip me and it makes you feel swell in this crummy southern town and this pretty hotel, but you'll never guess to who you're talking. No, you'll never guess to who you're talking. Then one night there's a scream in the
music from the new album, Son of Rogues Gallery, Pirate Ballads, Sea Songs, and Shanties, which was produced by our guest, Hal Wilner. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.